I'm here today at the Melbourne Writers Festival, and I've just caught up with Tony Birch just before he heads into a session on microfiction. Thanks for making the time, Tony.
Oh, pleasure.
Now, you've had several major publications. Your most recent novel, Blood, which was published last year and shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award, and Father's Day in 2009 and Shadowboxing in 2006.
Yep.
I wanted to speak today particularly perhaps about your short stories, because that's the session that you're sort of going into this afternoon, looking particularly at the stories in Father's Day. And I'm interested in the sort of characters that you choose to write about. It seems to me there's sort of a specific type of character that perhaps people wouldn't generally take too much notice of.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, I'm not saying the characters choose me, but I don't have a self-conscious type that I search out. But I think that I'm drawn to people and the potential for characters who are marginalised, who might exist on the periphery of mainstream society, and usually men, or men in particular, who have either been estranged from family or themselves choose to sit outside mainstream society. And in Father's Day in particular, I was trying to address both the difficulty of those sorts of characters and the unlikable aspects of characters such as that, but also to centre them, even for just the length of a story, to take them outside the margins and put the focus on them, and I would hope to give them some human value.
Well, particularly noticed today, I just picked up this publication, Seven Stories, which is being published for the festival, and I read your story in there, I think, Light in Winter.
Yeah.
Certainly a character that we probably would really regard as somebody on the outside of society, a homeless person.
Yeah.
What is it about that person that you think makes the story? What is it?
Oh, I suppose for me, I mean, my own father was homeless for some time, and I've come from a background where people literally exist financially on the margins and culturally, and I just think that we need to always understand that people who are doing less well than ourselves, or again, people who might be homeless, who might be drug users, who might live on the street, is to not look at them in a narrow way and understand the potential for full value in those characters. And I've always felt comfortable with those real life characters, in the sense that I never feel uncomfortable if someone approaches me on the street. I don't feel uncomfortable if someone's going a bit nutty on the tram or something. Yeah. I tend to be able to take that in the stride, and I just feel that story in particular was to try and develop a human relationship between a homeless man and a temporarily homeless young girl or teenager who he meets toward the end of the story, and to give them, I suppose, a moment of value.
And there are those moments in your stories, sort of small moments of intimacy. Perhaps I'm thinking of one of the story Father's Day in your collection. Mm-hmm. Towards the end, there's that when the son sort of spending time with the father, and he actually goes to the window and he looks out and he notices a woman picking fruit, I think, off the tree, and comes down the ladder and kisses the man on top of the head. And there's something about those moments of intimacy are very powerful in the middle of a story like that.
It's quite interesting, because with that story in Father's Day, when the man looks out of the window and he sees this elderly couple have that moment, I wasn't sure or conscious of what it might mean at the time. I literally thought, what does he see out the window? Okay, he sees into the next door neighbour's backyard. And what was interesting after that, I published a story called After Rachel, and not so miraculously, but that couple become the centre of the whole story. But I think it is those moments of tenderness that we can miss, those moments of intimacy. And it might be just a gesture between a couple. It could be the way that a mother brushes a child's cheek, when you're sitting on the tram, you see that touch between people. And I'm very, all of my books, they're very tactile in that sense. There's a lot of human interaction and physical touch. Sometimes it's abrasive, but as often or more often it is those moments of tenderness. And we can miss them, and we tend to miss them.
In that story, it seems to say a lot about the relationship between the father and the son as well. A lot
of
unstated intimacy that perhaps has never been expressed in that way, but it's there.
And I think that I love that story, because it's three generations, and what is interesting is that the grandchild and the grandfather are much more comfortable with each other than the adult child and father.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm interested in that as well, in the sense of generational attitudes. And I think that sometimes we get on much better with our grandparents than our parents do. So in other words, in my own life, that I had a fairly idealized, I suppose, image of my grandmother and a very strong relationship. But my mother had a much more difficult relationship with her, so that I think generational connection is really important, because it allows, I suppose, for older people to find tenderness that they sometimes weren't able to express through their own children, probably because of, you know, difficulties. They might have been busy, they might have been struggling financially. And I think being a grandparent in this sense, it gives people the opportunity to just have a much more relaxed and intimate relationship with grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. You said before that you do write a lot about men, and it seems to me sort of a particular type of man, a rugged, independent, pretty feisty sort of man. And I was thinking particularly of the men in the Two Dogs story. Sorry, I've forgotten the title. But
Two Men and Their Dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Is that sort of, are those men disappearing, do you think? Those feisty, independent, probably knocked around sort of Australian men, that are we becoming too sophisticated for that?
Oh, no, I'm sure they exist. They probably don't exist in the inner city of Melbourne so much, but I'm sure they exist out in the suburbs and, you know, in the countryside. And I suppose, again, when I was younger, I had much closer relationships with women, whether they be women my age or women in my family. But I think that as I've got older, I actually find that I value those friendships with men in a way that I wouldn't have thought possible when I was younger. And I think that, again, once you've got over the age of, you know, whether it be bravado or difficulty or whatever, I think once you get into your 40s and 50s, you can have a relationship with other men, which is a bit feisty and can be a bit rugged, to use your word. But I also think it becomes, again, there can be much stronger emotional connections, and I think you can let your guard down.
Yeah,
I mean, if you come from a background where showing emotion is frowned upon, you know, working class background, Aboriginal men, it's often very difficult to express emotion within communities. But I think as you get older, you can afford to let your guard down. And I think it's a bit of a shame that for some men, they can never do it, or some men, you know, they'd like to do it when they're younger, but they can't. And I just really enjoy the company of other men more than I used to, and more than I would have expected. So yeah, it's a very strong theme for me. And I think it's also about changing men. I'm interested in, and sometimes it's a subtext, but I'm interested in the potential for forgiveness.
Yes.
And I'm very much interested in the notion of redemption.
Yes.
So I don't think anyone should be cast out for all time. So people who have done stupid things and may be wrong, I think we need to find the potential to forgive them and bring them back into community and back into family.
And just on a sort of a slightly different level, I'm always interested in knowing where stories come from. What's that initial spark or ignition for a story? How do stories usually come to you?
Well, they do come as, they certainly, I like to call them triggers. To borrow a line from Richard Hugo, the American poet, who wrote a wonderful essay once called Triggering Towns, and it was about how an image could trigger a whole poem. Well, for me, it's similar, that I'll see something, I might witness a moment in the street, and you could think of them as the snapshots or a still frame that you might take with a camera, and I'll just be attracted to something, and it might be the way, again, that two people interacted. It could be something that's said or a gesture, and it just stands out amongst those other images that flash by us.
Yes.
And I usually initially just think, okay, I'm interested in this as an idea, and I'll make a note of it and do a little sketch. And then I tend to leave it and just wait and see what happens for a while, and usually it'll come back to me. I don't necessarily then go back to it and try and sort of beat a story out of it.
No.
I'm usually confident that in time that snapshot will come back to me, and then it'll start to develop into a story.
So do you think they need that sort of time to simmer away
in
the unconscious, or sit?
Yeah, I mean, I've got that formula of, letting it simmer away like a slow cooker.
Yeah.
And I'm a runner, and it might seem like an odd thing to say, but my running and writing go together. So I'll go for a long run sometimes, and as happens with that, your mind empties out, and then that image will come into my head, and it'll start to grow, and I'll tease it out a bit, and then I get home, and I'm pretty excited because, yeah, it's like something started to germinate quite literally.
Then, it is exciting.
And you, I know enough now about my own writing that when that moment happens, both the snapshot and then the germination, I do get excited because I think, I reckon there's a story
here. Yeah, I walk on the beach a lot, and I reckon that I do as much writing by walking on the beach
absolutely.
As I do as sitting down trying to write.
And it's interesting you say that, because I'm very much interested in walking and walking essays, and it doesn't have to be running, but I think it has to be something contemplative, but also contemplative where the mind has the ability to sort of empty out of stress or a bit of clutter.
Yeah.
And I'm actually interested in the way that I think there's a rhythmic relationship to your body as well. Mm. So you get into a zone where you feel quite comfortable and things just appear clearer.
Yes. That's right. Something about the motion, the actual movement that seems to free things up.
Whether it be the potential structure of a story or a problem you're having with a draft or a problem you're having at home, you just think a lot more clearly and calmly about it.
So as well as the beginning of a story, it seems to me that it's the ending that's crucial too, knowing where to stop. And how do you know where to stop? I mean, there's probably some unexpected stops in some of your story. I was thinking of the made-to-measure story where I didn't want it to stop, I wanted it to go on. So why do you stop sometimes when there's more knowledge probably to be gained or more to know?
Well, that's an interesting case, made-to-measure, because to sort of... to try and describe my own stories, I usually say I have like mini novels, beginning, middle and end stories as in structure. So the opening story, The Last Time I Saw Cherry, is a very sort of strong narrative story with a nice development. And I see that as the same way I might write a novel. A story like Made to Measure or a story like The Ward, another story from Father's Day, I just call them quiet moments to me, and they're contemplative, and certainly they could go on further. And usually, I suppose that they're a story that I feel I do want to leave the action before the characters do. Now, that might seem odd, and in that story, where at the end of the story, the father and the son are sitting around the kitchen table talking quietly, and one of the things that comes up is their shared evenness of breath as they're sitting there. Mm. And I did feel in that story, I'm just going to walk out of here and leave them there.
Yeah.
Now, I know some readers, my younger brother in particular, he always is at me about those sort of stories. He wants more. And I think occasionally there's a tendency to want to give more, but I just feel... probably with those stories, it's more like, because I've published enough poetry as well to know that they're more akin to the poems that I've written, where it's just not all there and there's a lot for the reader to contemplate. And I hope that for a reader who wants more, they're left with a yearning and a curiosity rather than just simply a frustration.
Yes.
So if it's the former, I'm very happy. If it's the latter, I'd be a bit disappointed.
Just sort of to finish up on sort of noticing sort of how many different types of writing you're involved in. You're writing short stories, your novel, poetry. I think you're involved in the non-fiction conference in November at RMIT. And numerous other things. Do you like that sort of that spread of different types of writing? Is that important to you to be doing different things?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love writing short stories most of all. Writing Blood was a much more arduous process, and the outcome is very enjoyable. The writing wasn't as enjoyable. I mean, it's much more rigorous, and it's a lot to carry in your head. But I do like the range, and to be quite honest, if someone says to me, we'd like you to write an essay, I've done a fair amount of essays on artists' profiles. I just think here's an invitation to tell a story in a different way.
Mm.
And when I'm approached to do nonfiction in particular, it's usually because, although it's nonfiction, I have a good angle or a good way to tell a story rather than write a technical or critical piece.
Mm.
And my view is that anytime someone offers you the chance to publish, never knock it back without thinking about it, because in the end, it's difficult to publish. And if someone says, okay, here's 1,000 words or 2,000 words, my first thought is, I'll write something because I want to be continually published. That would be wrong. is that, do I have something to contribute here? And usually I find that I do. I find that an idea comes to fruition. And particularly if I'm working with other people, particularly artists, I love the conversation. And you mentioned at the outset today the Seven Stories project with the artist Jim Pavlidis. I love collaboration. I love collaborating with artists in particular because it's just a wonderful shared experience.
Just a final sort of question really relating to the session that you're about to go into soon, which is about microfiction, I guess. Have you got sort of ready-made definitions of what microfiction is? I'm just sort of asking because sometimes I think there's a bit of a tendency for some, what like people call short stories, just to be short pieces of writing, but they don't quite have the spark of what I'd sort of expect. They don't have that lingering sort of aspect, or they don't take you anywhere. They just tell you something in a shorter period of time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll say up front, I'm going in there as a fraud. I don't know how I got into this session because my shortest short stories are about 2,000 words, so I'm not a microfiction writer, so maybe they have me in there as the antithesis. But I think you're right. I mean, that sometimes it might feel like a nice paragraph of writing that conjures up something of an image, but it's, you're left a bit flat after the reading. I think Josephine Rowe, who is on the session, and she has two books out, When a Moth Becomes a Boat was her first book, and her second book is Tarkata Wake. I think Josephine is a writer in particular who is able to produce short stories or microfiction where you do get a sense of something more than just an idea or an image or a frame. But, I mean, there's a lot of debate around microfiction because some of it, when you look at it, it just, you know, it feels more like a what we would call a prose poem. And, you know, even prose poetry, I think Charles Simic, who wrote a lot of prose poems, I think he said it was a bastard of an idea, or the bastard child of both poetry and prose. So it is a bit of a sort of hybrid form. I think in the end is that when you're finished reading a piece of short fiction, it is, I think it's the taste on in the mouth and how you feel about it, whether it works or not. And I think most people, they don't do it quite as well, someone like Josephine Rowe does, who I think really that's her form. And she works internally in a way that I think someone like myself, if I tried to do a short story, I'm sure I would just do that version that you started with. It'd be a half-assed idea that wasn't going anywhere.
Well, half-assed or full-assed, we look forward very much to your stories and your writing in the future. It's been terrific to catch up with you today, Tony. Thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you very much.